Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, September 26th, 2013. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Chris Colby of BeerAndWineJournal.com joins me to talk about a new experiment that we'd like you to do with us concerning hoppy beers. Also, we visit the other end of the spectrum and talk in detail about how to brew tasty German wheat beers. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. You can follow me on Twitter. My username is basicbrewing, all one word. Also, you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james, and our show page on Facebook is at facebook.com/basicbrewing. We're on Google Plus, too. And thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. You know how that works. Whenever you think of Amazon shopping, go to our site first. Go to basicbrewing.com, click on the Amazon ad. That will take you to Amazon, where we will get a cut of whatever you buy. And one thing about the Amazon link, in the past show, I shared a tip from a listener to add a bookmark to your browser with the URL from our Amazon ad. Apparently, somebody tells me that may not be a good idea. I heard from another listener, Dione, who said if you use a bookmark, it may not work. We may not get credit for what you buy. Apparently, Dione tried that and wound up not getting credit for some purchases. So, to be safe, please take that extra step and go to our site to click on the Amazon logo before you go Amazon shopping. We appreciate very much your extra effort to do so. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app on iTunes and our Android app on Amazon.com. We're on the BlackBerry podcast directory. We're on the Stitcher app, and we're on the Windows Phone directory, too. Man, we're everywhere. Check out our Brewer's Logbook at BasicBrewingShop.com. In the front is a blank calendar that you can use to track your fermentations and plan your brews. And there is room in the back to log the details of up to 50 batches of beer. If you want to put a tip in our tip jar, some coinage in our guitar case, you can go to basicbrewing.com/support. Thanks to everybody who has done so already. Protect your precious beer with one of our growler bags. Check those out at basicbrewingshop.com. Well, Chris and I have a lot to talk about, so let's just get right to it. Chris Colby, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Hey, James. Thanks for having me on the show.
Chris Colby of BeerAndWineJournal.com. We are going to talk about two things today. First of all, we're going to get back into the experimental mode. It's brewing season. People need to be brewing. People need to be thinking. People need to be finding out new things and helping us find out new things. So we've come up with an experiment that we're going to do. And we're also going to enlist your help out there in podcast land to cooperate with us. And this is the first time we're going to do something like this on the BeerAndWineJournal.com site. What are we going to do? What do we got in mind?
Well, we thought we'd kick off with something that's actually pretty simple, but also I think fairly interesting and topical. And on people's minds right now, there's the idea that sort of quasi recently filtered into the homebrew community about when you make an IPA, adjusting your what they call the chloride to sulfate ratio in your brewing liquor in your brewing water, and the idea is that the sort of old idea used to be just add gypsum, which would give your water calcium sulfate. But the newer idea is you need a little bit of chloride in there, usually from calcium chloride, to balance that out a bit. And so the idea is that the lower your chloride to sulfate ratio is, the more sulfate you have as opposed to chloride, the more that will enhance the bitterness of your beer. And we have an experiment to test two different things. One is, can you adjust this ratio after you've brewed the beer, or do you have to, adjust that ratio in the boil. And then the second question would be, if you can and it works, how great is the effect in beer? And the nice thing about this is all you need to do is brew 5 gallons of IPA to get it to work. Because what the experiment is this, you'll start with starting with either distilled water or RO water, or if you happen to know that your water has extremely low chloride in it, brew up a batch of IPA with a 1-to-1 chloride to sulfate ratio. So that would be, that would put it in the balanced spectrum of what they say the chloride to sulfate ratio does. Then what you do is bottle the beer, and not kegging it, well, bottle the beer, and what you'll do is bottle off the first gallon at a 1-to-1 chloride to sulfate ratio. Then you'll stir in a little gypsum, let it sit for a couple of minutes just to make sure it dissolves. Bottle off the second gallon of IPA at a 1-to-2 chloride to sulfate ratio. Then stir in a little bit more gypsum. Give it a minute or two to soak in, to dissolve. Bottle of the third gallon at a 1-to-3, and repeat that 1-to-4, 1-to-5, so that you'll have 5 different sets of IPA going, ranging from a 1-to-1 chloride to sulfate ratio to 1-to-5. And it should be something that one is easy to do, because you're brewing one batch of beer. And it also should be, you know, I think a lot of people, myself included, have been interested in that, because it's one of the beer styles, you know, along with stout and a few of the others, where like mucking with your water chemistry is really has the potential to bring great rewards, whereas sort of middle of the road amber ales, you know, you've got quite a lot of leeway in how your water chemistry works out, and you can still brew good beers. And anyway, I just think it'll be fun.
And you're going to put the details on the procedure and recipe, a sample recipe. I'm sure everybody's got their own IPA recipe, but you know, I think that it would be cool if both of us could brew kind of the same recipe or something pretty similar. You'll put both of those in a post on beerandwinejournal.com?
Right. Those will be up today.
Today being, yeah, we're posting us on Wednesday.
I'll
either
put it up Wednesday.
Yeah, okay.
Wednesday morning, it'll be there.
It's hard working in the future.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm excited about that. I need to brew a pale ale, and, you know, it'd be fun to get back into the experimental things. Been brewing a lot lately, or more than certainly I have in the past few months, so it's good. It feels good to dust the cobwebs and dust off the brewing equipment and get it working again.
Definitely. And we've also we set a deadline for this experiment of Halloween.
Yeah.
Easy to remember.
So it's about 6 weeks, so that you should have plenty of time to brew up a hoppy pale ale and play with the chemicals a little bit, and we'll see what happens. Do you have any predictions, or are you just going into it with an open mind?
Yeah, I don't know. I've read about the chloride to sulfate ratio, but no one has ever, I've never read an explanation of why exactly it's happening. If it's some reaction in the boil that's interacting with the hops to, you know, extract more or a different set of like alpha acids or, you know, other resins in the hops, or if it's just something that, is something that influences how your tongue interacts. So I'm not going to give any predictions. I'm just going to.
And is this coming out of a formal? Yeah, I mean this theory of the ratio, is it coming out of formal publications, or is this just sort of internet bread?
It originated in the actual scientific brewing literature somewhere. I can't, off the top of my head, I remember where. But yeah, it's an idea that trickled down from professional brewing, commercial brewing.
Okay, let's switch gears from hoppy beers to certainly just as flavorful in other ways are the German wheat beers. You are currently doing a wrapping up, I guess, a series on German wheat beers. And thanks to Kyle Clark, who he and his family from Wisconsin came down a few weeks ago. We did a little beer trade while he was in town, and he gave me several beers from Wisconsin, and one that certainly fits in this category is from Lakefront Brewery. It's called Wisconsinite Summer Weissbier. Is it Weissbier or Weissbier?
I think the German pronunciation is Weissbier.
Okay. Well, we'll be appropriate. Wisconsinite Summer Weissbier, and I didn't even I opened it, and I drank it, thinking that a Weiss beer would be, you know, a wheat beer can be anything. But this, man, it was full of banana and clove, and especially clove. And I was surprised. I tasted it and I said, this is a spiced beer. And I looked on the website, and there's no mention of spice whatsoever. It does say if it's not from Wisconsin, it's not in this beer. Apparently everything came from Wisconsin. The yeast is a strain that's been bred in Wisconsin. Malt, hops, wheat, water, all of it. So that's a good example of the style if you're in Wisconsin. So, yeah, it's a style that is all about the spiciness and the fruitiness, but there's no spice or fruit in it.
Yeah, the spice character and the fruit character, which is the spice character is frequently described as clove. It's a phenolic sort of flavor, and the most prominent of the fruity characters is banana, although in some cases you additionally get bubblegum and some other things. But yeah, it's a beer that, like many Belgians, the spiciness comes from the yeast.
So let's start in the beginning. Let's talk about water. How are we going to treat our water? Do we need any water treatment for a nice German wheat beer?
You know, the interesting thing in Eric Warner's book on wheat beers, he mentions that they're brewed from almost any starting water. You know, they've got there are breweries there that have very, very soft water, and there's breweries there that have you know, very, very hard water with a lot of alkalinity. So it. Unlike some other styles that we've talked about recently, this one really doesn't have really tight water requirements. All you really need to do is adjust the mash pH to get it within the normal range, and so you can and you can do that in a couple ways. You can just add calcium in the form of either gypsum or calcium chloride or a mixture of both. You can directly acidify the mash if you've got some, you know, food grade phosphoric acid or lactic acid. A more traditional German way would be to substitute some of your Pilsner malt in the beer with acidulated malt. Mm. This is malt that has a very high concentration of lactic acid bacteria on the outside of it. And so really, yeah, your water chemistry isn't the key to success here. All you need to do is get the mash pH to fall somewhere within the normal range, and you're doing good.
And I would assume that being wheat beer, there'd be wheat in the wheat in the grain bill.
That's a very good assumption. Yeah, the grist for wheat beer is usually or is almost always simply a pale malt, usually Pilsner. You know, pale barley malt and wheat malt. There's usually, you know, there are certainly exceptions. There's a lot of wheat beers brewed in Germany and elsewhere, but the sort of classic formulation is just barley malt and wheat malt. And the wheat malt is usually, or at least the sort of classic Munich area formulation, is 70% wheat and 30% barley. But by German law, the their only constriction on it is that it has to be 50% or more wheat. So they sort of run the gamut from, you know, 50% wheat up to, well, I'm sure there's probably examples over 70% wheat, but that's kind of the classic.
But you say in the in one of the articles that it's a misperception that the wheat is, or the amount of wheat is proportional to the amount of spiciness or fruitiness in the finished beer?
Yeah, the combination of having a high percentage of wheat that you don't see in a lot of other beers, along with the aroma characteristics that you don't see in other beers, has led some people to speculate that, you know, the more wheat you put in it, the more wheat beery it gets. And that's not really true. Actually, in Wolfgang Kunz's book, Technology, Brewing, and Malting, he says that experiments have found that 60-40 blend brings out the clove the most, although that's it's like a secondary or tertiary effect. It's not the primary way that the clove shows up. There's two big things that lead to that.
So can you you say a percentage of barley malt? What kind of barley malt are we looking at?
Usually Pilsner malt. And if you're planning to do a decoction mash, trying to get under-modified Pilsner malt would be good. It's not necessary strictly, but you'd be better off.
And that leads into an entirely different conversation on on both under-modified and decoction. So check the archives for those two. So what kind of wheat? Red wheat? White wheat?
Traditionally, German brewers used red wheat. You can use white wheat. It's fine. And there's also, I mean, there's three different distinctions between wheat. There's whether it's red or white. There's whether it's summer or winter, and whether it's hard or soft. And so you've got, out there, there's typically a lot of choices or whatever, but usually the descriptors you find in wheat that's been malted and for sale, the big thing is you usually find either red or white, and red is generally preferred for Hefeweizens, although if your homebrew shop only carries white, it's fine. It's, you know, not going to make that big of a difference. And just incidentally, the red is from some there are some phenolic molecules on the outside of the wheat that they're slightly red colored, but those don't add color to your beer. It's not like if you use red wheat, your Hefeweizen turns on amber or anything like that. It's very subtle. You can see it if you saw the kernels of the two laying side by side, but it doesn't show up in the final beer.
So could I make I've been playing a lot with 100% wheat beers and 100% rye beers. Could I make a sort of spicy, phenolic, fruity wheat beer without any barley?
You could, sure. And on the flip side, you could make one without any wheat either, because one of the key molecules that leads to the clove flavor clove flavor in German Hefeweizens is mostly due to a molecule called 4-vinyl guaiacol, and the precursor for that is a molecule called ferulic acid, and wheat is relatively high in ferulic acid. It's sort of stuck to some sugars in the bran. The bran is the outside of the wheat, so in the mash that gets released, and then in fermentation, if you use the right wheat beer strain, that gets converted to the ferulic acid gets converted to 4-vinyl guaiacol, and you get that clove flavor. But barley also has ferulic acid. It's my understanding, not quite to the levels that wheat does, but that they both contain it.
So how do we prepare a mash to best accentuate these flavors that we're looking for?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. You can do just a single infusion mash at normal temperatures if you want to. That'll work fine. You use the right yeast and you'll get a wheat beer tasting beer. But if you really, if you want to go out of your way and accentuate the clove aspect of it, you can do something called a ferulic acid rest, which is a rest within about a degree Celsius of 44 Celsius, which is 111 Fahrenheit. So within a couple degrees of 111 Fahrenheit. And anyway, in this ferulic acid rest, it, at least the theory goes that it releases the ferulic acid from the sugars that it's bound to and makes it, you know, free ferulic acid in the wort. And so, if you want to do a ferulic acid rest, you have a couple options. You can do, especially if you have a heatable mash tun, you can simply do a heated step mash. Mm-hmm. Just mash in low about 10 minutes for the ferulic acid rest. Then you can heat it up to what would traditionally be called the protein rest. You know, rest there for, you know, however long you want. And it differs. It's really not going to matter as much as you think.
But a rule of thumb.
Yeah, I mean, it will a little bit because it's a wheat beer, but I mean, these days, most of the protein modification is taking place at the maltster. So, like, doing a, if it was a pure barley beer, the protein rest doesn't do, you know, so what it sort of used to do on the more under modified malts of the time. And so, anyway, then you heat it up to saccharification range, let it, you know, convert the starches to sugar, and then finally, especially since you're dealing with a wheat beer, you know, do yourself a favor and heat it up to the mash out levels, so you makes your lautering a little easier. Wheat beers have sort of they've got a reputation as being hard to louter, but really, if you just do a mash out and you just don't rush the wort collection, in practice, it's not that big of a deal, you know. And if you're really worried about it, you know, there's always string in a few rice hulls, but generally, if you just if you do the mash out and you just don't try to run off the wort like super fast, you'll have the 30% barley's will contribute enough husks to the grain bed to work.
Or if you're really worried, you can do brew in a bag.
Yeah, you could try that.
So we've collected our wort. Is there anything much different in the boil of a German wheat beer than other beers?
Boil, not really. Pretty standard. One thing, though, given that barley is huskless, there are fewer tannins, and also the low hopping rate. There's sort of fewer tannins in a wheat wort than compared to a wort made with barley malt. And, you know, one of the among the goals in your boil is to precipitate, you know, protein tannin complexes. So one thing, just to make sure that you've done all you can, it's if you have the time, it's a little bit better to boil a wheat wort for like 90 minutes versus 60. But again, it's the sort of thing that if you know, did the standard 60 minute boil, it's not that, you know, it's not that your wheat beer will be ruined. It's just might not work out as well. And also, given you expect some haze in the beer, you know, so if you don't completely, sediment out those protein tannins, which contribute one kind of haze, it's not really going to hurt your beer to have, you know, a couple different kinds of haze in it versus one here, because you're not going to know.
So the you said that I think you accidentally said barley was huskless. It's wheat that's huskless.
Wheat, yeah.
Which reminds me, we kind of skipped the step of milling. It's more difficult if you've got a hand crank mill like I do. You'll discover that that milling wheat is a bit harder than milling malted barley.
Yeah, if you, if you ever dealt with either barley or wheat seeds, they're like super rock hard, the actual grain. When you malt it, it softens it up, but wheat malt is just significantly harder than barley malt. And yeah, hand cranking it gets to be, you know, it's a good exercise. It's a good workout. And a lot of people, when they brew a wheat beer, the wheat malt is typically larger too. Each kernel is a little bit plumper than barley kernels. And so a lot of people will mill the two different malts separately. You know, they'll go through, mill the barley malt as they normally would, and then adjust the mill and redo the wheat malt. And it's kind of funny because different brewers approach it differently. Some people tighten up the mill gap to really crush the wheat into, you know, a very fine. Other people, I guess for lautering purposes, actually, and because the kernels are bigger, actually widen the mill gap a little bit and crush a little bit more with lautering in mind. Generally, my sort of rule of thumb is, because this makes it really simple, is just run through the barley malt and then just run through a little bit of wheat malt and adjust the gap just so that the crush looks about the same. Mm. You know, it looks like you're getting the same amount of big pieces versus little pieces and flour and stuff. And if you do that, you know, you're usually good. You've charted a good course between extract efficiency and lauterability, you know, assuming you're not crushing your barley malt into dust.
So let's skip back to, in a nonlinear fashion, to the end of the boil. We chill down. So what target temperature, what target pitching temperature are we looking at?
You generally want to start low. I mean, a lot of homebrewers will sort of ferment wheat beer in the range that a typical English ale is fermented at. But you really sort of would be better off dropping that down a little bit. In Warner's book, he mentions there's a German rule of thumb is that if you add up the temperature that the yeast was pitched at and the fermentation temperature, it should equal 30. So if you're going to ferment at that's 30 degrees Celsius. And incidentally, if you're doing that, you need to do that all in Celsius, because if you add it up in Fahrenheit and then convert to Celsius later, it doesn't work. But yeah, anyway, so let me click on that.
So I've got a little thermometer thingy here in front of me. So 10 degrees Celsius would be about 50 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yep.
And then, so if you pitched at, for ease of mathematics, if you pitched at that temperature, and then fermented at 20 degrees Celsius, which would be around 68 Fahrenheit, then that would be correct. So that's a pretty big swing.
Hang on one second. Let me click up this. Because Warner gives what the classic one is. Okay, they mentioned beer pitched at 54, which is sort of mid lager temperature, and then fermented at 64. And 54 Fahrenheit is 12 degrees C, and 64 Fahrenheit is 18 degrees C. So that would be one. And, you know, I know a lot of homebrewers probably, you know, their ability to cool the wort all the way down to 54 might be lost. And in that case, I would say just if you could just get it down, you know, to the mid-60s and hold it there during fermentation, you're probably in good shape. You know, if you can go that extra step and pitch lower and have the fermentation rise up, that's pretty good. And even if you let the fermentation, even if the best you can do is hold it at, say, 68, which is 20 degrees C, you know, all is not lost. You might have more banana, although you can decrease that by increasing your pitching rate. One of the main ideas, if not the main idea, in conducting a wheat beer fermentation is that as as you get stronger worts, like thicker worts, less aeration, less pitching, and higher temperatures, all these things lead to more of the clove aspect in the beer. And by the same token, because it's a yeast byproduct, by the same thing, these all also increase the banana. You know, that's the same set of things that increases esters in beers. And so if you want to manipulate the 4VG, the 4-vinyl guaiacol to banana ratio, what you need to know is that the esters increase a lot more quickly than the phenolic, the 4VG. So if you want to brew a beer and favor banana, you know, go ahead and ferment at a higher temperature, because although there'll be more clove, there'll be just so much more banana that is blown out. But if you want there to be more clove, bring down the fermentation temperature, you know, and let, because the clove will sort of at the lower range of concentration sort of, you know, poke its way through the banana flavors and get more balance. So it's basically, yeah, clove low, banana high for fermentation temperatures.
That's a t-shirt.
Yeah, there you go.
Clove low, banana high. And and you wrote an article about sort of the chemistry of what's going on, you know, for those who want to get into more detail about that side of things, including little diagrams of, you know, molecules and such.
And also a little explanation of what those mean, because they, I know they show up in at brewing, you know, publications all the time, but I'm not, you know, I'm sure there's some people who don't have the chemistry background and just wonder, like, you know, what are all these squiggly little lines doing here? You know, what's it telling me, you know? And, yeah, in that article, yeah, I review several of the molecules that are relevant in wheat beer brewing, and they also show up in some other, in some Belgians and some others, and it's just kind of interesting that there's a whole suite of, if you look at 4-vinyl guaiacol, there's a whole suite of like related molecules, and they all have some sort of flavor associated with them. Like you can take 4-vinyl guaiacol and take off one like hydroxyl group and add an ethyl group to one of its side chains, and suddenly it's ethyl cinnamate, which is cinnamon. You can change it a little bit, and it's the I forget what all you have to remove one of the side groups, and it becomes eugenol, which is the actual like clove in cloves. Because 4-vinyl guaiacol is not the same molecule that cloves is, but it's very closely related. And, you know, just little changes in the composition of the molecule, basically, because these are all phenolic molecules, so they've got a 6-carbon ring at the center of it, and it's the difference between them, the ones that I discuss here, are just a different side chain either being added or not. And so, I don't know, I found that interesting. I don't know if anyone else did, but...
Well, the different yeast strains will give different results. Will also accentuate different compounds. What are your favorites?
Yeah, in order to brew a German wheat beer, you need a beer that's going to pump out the 4-vinyl guaiacol and the banana esters. And if you do everything the same as in a normal ale and pitch like a normal, you know, English strain or a normal clean lager strain or a clean ale strain or a lager strain, you wouldn't get all, you know, that wheat beer nose to the beer. I mean, we've all had American wheat beers, right, where it's, you know, made with wheat, it looks cloudy, but you taste it and it's got a clean ale flavor. Mm-hmm. So you need the right yeast. And the interesting thing, this is the sciencey stuff, is what interests me in a lot of this, is there's an individual gene, which is called the POF gene, and if that gene makes the product that it's supposed to, you know, genes code for proteins that are enzymes. And in this case, the PF gene makes a protein that's called either ferulic acid decarboxylase, or sometimes it's called, I think, cinnamate decarboxylase. But anyway, it's an enzyme that takes a phenolic molecule that's similar in shape to 4-vinylguaiacol or 4-vinylguaiacol, and takes a carboxyl group off of it. And so anyway, the sort of yeasts that are this way are the wheat beer yeasts, the anything labeled, you know, Hefeweizen or German wheat beer or whatever. Those yeasts are the what are called POF plus, because the gene actually works. Also, incidentally, bread yeast is generally POF plus. Most wine yeasts are, but there are a few that are POF minus. And I guess you don't get the wheat beer flavor in a wine because there's not the precursor there. Although I would guess if you ferment it at high enough temperature, you could get the banana, maybe.
There are different. You go over in the article. You go over a lot of a bunch of different strains and the characteristics that they are supposed to accentuate.
Okay, yeah, there are a couple strains at least available to homebrewers. There's sort of the classic strain, which originated with the Weihenstephan Brewery. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, incidentally. And you can get it as a homebrewer either as Y Yeast 3068, which they call Weihenstephan Weizen, or White Labs WOP 300, which they call Hefeweizen Ale. And this this strain sort of gives the classic wheat beer characteristic. If you manage that your pitching rate and your aeration and your fermentation temperatures, you can get the nice, you know, balanced clove and banana flavor that, you know, you've probably tasted in many German wheat beers. That there's another strain which is, let's see, I believe it's Y Yeast 3638 and White Labs WOP 380. I think those are the same strain. Mr. Malty has a strain identifier that mixes it up, but there's a secondary strain that's very good, and the main difference is the other strain produces more of the other esters. So along with bananas, you can get some other things like apple and plum mixed in there. A little bit more. Some people describe it as a little more complex. Definitely, if you want to stress the fruity side over the clove, that would be a good one to go with. And there's a couple other strains, and there's also at least one mixed strain out there, or there are a strain mixture that's sold. But yeah, you've got a lot. You've got at least a fair amount of wheat yeasts to experiment with, and given that the yeast exerts such an influence on the way the beer turns out, brewing one of these is really a good candidate for a split batch. I mean, if you're normally a 5-gallon brewer and you can scale up to 10 gallons and make fill 2 carboys, that's really the way to go. And especially if you've never tried it before, try out a couple different strains. Or if not, just split into 2-3 gallon carboys and do 2.5 gallons if 5 gallons is the most you can produce in your brew house. But yeah, it's a really and it's one, you know, frequently homebrewers do that if they're gonna make a Hefeweizen, split it between 2 different strains and get 2 different good wheat beers out of it.
Yeah, that's a great idea. So let's talk about packaging. Typically, this is served cloudy. If it's bottled, there's sediment on the bottom of the bottle. You rouse up the yeast and pour it cloudy. So how does that affect the way we homebrewers package this?
Yeah, German Hefeweizens are almost always bottled versus kegged. I mean, there are kegged examples out there, but they're generally bottled conditioned so that they have a yeast at the bottom. And yeah, as you say, when they're served, a lot of people, or a lot of Germans at least, will at the end they'll swirl the dregs at the bottom and pour that into the beer to make it extra cloudy. And yeah, as homebrewers, obviously we're very used to bottle conditioning our beer, and so that's not really a problem. The one sort of twist on the one sort of difference that wheat beers have versus other ales is they're typically very highly carbonated. Whereas a typical like American beer, craft beer, will be carbonated to about, you know, 2.5 or 2.6 volumes of CO2. Wheat beers are, you know, 3.5 to 5 sometimes.
Wow.
You know, so they're highly carbonated, and you can approach that one of two ways. And this is going to be the last of the wheat beer series. Is the easy way is just to add the appropriate amount of priming sugar, and you can do it that way. And I recently posted a article on just priming sugar and how to hit your right carbonation levels, and so that's the way that most homebrewers approach it. But the way that the Germans do it is depending on the brewery, they'll either retain some wheat beer wort, or I mean, if they're a working brewery, they're generating new wheat beer wort every day. A few actually generate a wort that's different from their normal wheat beer. But anyway, they take wheat beer wort, inoculate it with lager yeast. Usually, there are some exceptions. So they have essentially a fermenting wheat lager, and they add that as their priming sugar, essentially. Mix that in and bottle it, and then store the bottles somewhat warm. In Fahrenheit, it'd be like 75 to 80 degrees. Not quite as hot as a lot of Belgian breweries bottle condition, even above that. But they add the Spezza, which is what they call the fermenting lager beer, and that's essentially their priming sugar. And you can do that, and I'll explain how to do that. Although it's kind of twitchy because you want the beer to be fermenting, but then you also want to, if it ferments too much, then it's fermented too much of the sugar away, and you don't get enough carbonation. But if it's just started and you add it, you know, you don't want 6 or 7 volumes of carbon dioxide in a beer. not unless you're unless the bottles are very far away from you. And so it can be a little bit twitchy. And also, given that homebrewers, you know, you either have to save the wort from brew day, and that's an extra step, or brew another wheat beer that day. Most of them just rely on the corn sugar, but you can do it with the Spezza. And the one thing to note about bottling a Hefeweizen is it's really good to do it in those 500 mil heavy Hefeweizen beer bottles. If you do it in a lot of the replaceable or recyclable thin sort of 12-ounce glass bottles, you run the risk of having one shatter. And then if they're sitting next to each other, you have a risk of several of them shattering.
So if there's yeast in the bottle of a commercial example, can you culture up that yeast, and can you be guaranteed that yeast is the actual Hefeweizen yeast?
Well, you're actually more guaranteed that it's the lager strain from the Spezza than from the ale fermentation. It would be, you know, it would be a mix of the two, but yeah, generally, if you culture beer yeast from a Hefeweizen, it's going to be mostly lager yeast, which is not what you want. There are some exceptions. The Schneider Brewery reputedly they only use one strain, both for bottling and for fermentation. So you can try it with Schneider Weiss, and beyond that, I'm not sure. I just know that the general rule that most brewers use lager yeast rather than the fermentation yeast for bottling.
I guess one trick that you could do, or one test that you could do, would be to culture up a very small starter from the dregs of a bottle, and if it does smell and taste like you would expect, then you probably have the real thing. Otherwise, if it's too clean, you probably should toss that and buy some.
Yeah, if it was lager yeast, if you cultured some, fermented it out at, like, say, 58 or something, that would be low enough that if it was a plain lager yeast, it would ferment out very clean. But if it was a wheat yeast, it would, you'd get some clove coming out of that.
Well, very good. This is a fun thing. This would be a fun thing to do, with my series of fairly low gravity, all wheat, or all wheat and some barley, or not barley, but rye beers, to make some interesting session-y beers as well.
Yeah, and the chemistry article got me thinking about a couple things. And one of them is that there's another molecule that's very similar to ferulic acid that's called peak humic acid. And it's also found in wheat, and that gets turned into 4-vinyl phenol, which is very similar to 4-vinyl guaiacol. In fact, the enzyme that converts ferulic acid to 4-vinyl guaiacol is the same enzyme that converts peak humic acid to 4-vinyl phenol. And anyway, humic acid is found in honey. So it'd be interesting to see if you fermented a mead with a wheat yeast, would you get that something similar to that classic wheat beer nose in the mead, or would it be totally different because it's not 4-vinyl guaiacol, it's 4-vinyl phenol. And also, like, another one of those molecules, there's a cinnamon one, but there's similar molecules that turn into vanillin, which is the main product in, or the main constituent of the essential oil of vanilla. And, there's just a lot of similar compounds like that. And so it'd be interesting to maybe even just as an experiment, try a real wide range of yeast strains, maybe even wine strains, on a wheat beer wort and try to see what flavors you could get to pop out. You know, it would be probably a lot of hit and miss. You'd probably be going through a lot of beers that just like, oh, this just tastes like an American wheat. This just tastes like an American wheat. But, I mean, you never know. You never know until you try it, and there might be some weird flavor combinations if you can develop enough of the ferulic acid at the beginning. I think that might be an interesting experiment.
Sure.
It might be a long and ultimately pointless experiment also, but
but if you like American wheat beers.
Then you might be set. If you like American wheat beers and a small percentage chance of success, then that's the experiment for you.
Well, speaking of experiments, remember, take a look at the blog, beerandwinejournal.com, to get all the details on how to help participate in our experiment on the making the testing of the gypsum and the hoppy. We need a snappier title than that, but that's...
And we'll also, on the website, we'll have exactly what to do with the beer chemistry, or the water chemistry. So if you're not, if the idea of water chemistry is, like, putting you off because you think, like, oh, that's too technical, well, it'll be step-by-step at how to do it, exact measurements and all that. So, we're hoping, because it's an easy experiment to do, it's a popular style of beer, we're hoping that, we'll get quite a few participants and get some fun results and also have 5 gallons of IPA to drink.
Woohoo! All right. Well, thanks, Chris.
Thanks, James.
Well, thanks again to Chris. looking forward to doing the experiment with the hoppy beer and the gypsum, the additional gypsum. Kind of a hard thing, the additional gypsum. It'll be a fun way to play with water chemistry and see what the impact is. And it'll be, you know, at the end of it, you'll have some tasty beers. So what's not to like? If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Our Basic Brewing growler bags are available in the shop. Protect your precious homebrew and craft beer as you take them from place to place. Check out our support link, where you can throw a couple of bucks into the tip jar by subscribing financially to our podcasts. And be sure to check out our DVDs, of course, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. We've got combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time, and you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store, too. Our brewer's logbooks are on the store as well. Keep track of up to 50 batches of beer. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We greatly appreciate the support. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Poo-Pourri Original Before You Go Bathroom Spray, 16-ounce refill size. That's a funny commercial. And Get Naked Puppy Health Dental Chew Sticks for puppies and dogs. Puppies are also dogs. But anyway, thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We greatly appreciate your support. Don't forget you can also join the American Homebrewers Association and subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine through the associate links on basicbrewing.com as well. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. Talk to you next time, everybody. So long.